In all of Major League Baseball history, going back 100 years, there have been just a handful of pitchers who have won at least 30 games or more in a single season. 30 games in a single season. Now, that short list includes names like Cy Young and Grover Cleveland Alexander and Dizzy Dean. The last to do it did it in 1968, 51 years ago. It was on a Saturday, September 14th, 1968, that Detroit Tigers right-hander Denny McClain struck out 10 batters as the Tigers beat the Oakland Athletics. Now fast forward 20 years, almost to the day, and that's when I met and interviewed Denny McClain.
I don't remember a lot about the ballgame, and I don't remember much about the entire season. It was kind of a blur. It was such a good time, and when you're having a good time, you don't look back. I do remember a number of items that occurred that day. One, Reggie Jackson hit two home runs off me on the same pitch twice. I threw him a hanging curveball the first time. I didn't think he could do it again, and I hung it the same place the second time, and he hit it farther. And I remember jumping into the dugout, of the Tiger dugout, and hitting my head on the top. It was a very solid cement in that dugout, and about knocked me out. Now, there's a very famous photograph that appeared in Sports Illustrated with Al Kaline with his arm around me. What actually the truth of the matter was, Kaline, while he was congratulating me, was also steadying me coming out of the dugout. I mean, I really bashed my head. Of course, I remember the Horton double to win the ball game. I remember, this is all in the same inning, by the way, I remember Danny Cater throwing the ball away at home plate. I still think Cater was on our payroll that day. It was such an easy play to make. And my wife threw a terrific party after the ball game. We had a terrific time.
And one of the greatest World Series in modern times.
It sure was. Listen, Mickey Lolich made my season. Mickey, who had not pitched well at all year, he'd got his brains beaten out, all of a sudden became the hero of the World Series and won three ball games. Because winning 30 ball games was an accomplishment, but it would not have shined as bright had we not won the World Series. And Mickey certainly added to the shining of that year.
Was there too much pressure on you the following year? Did they expect you to win 30 again?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I was ahead of the schedule at one time, and I won 24 the next year. But, it's like I've always said, you've got to have everything in place every time you go out there to win 30. It's you got to be lucky. You got to get all the breaks. They've got to score runs for you early. You got to get a game once in a while. Half of your ball games, you got to get three or four runs early so the tension and the pressure on your shoulder is not as great. You can relax a little bit. All of those things cumulatively will make you have a good year. 69, I had a good year, and I thought I pitched better in 69 than I did 68, but I struck out 100 guys less, and there were a number of things that happened in 68. They reduced the size of the mound. They reduced it from 16 inches to 10 inches, and that was a dramatic thing to happen to me because I used as much leverage as I could, and starting in late 67, of course, I had a lot of shoulder problems, and in 69 is when I really got into cortisone.
You had a great form. I used to love to watch you pitch.
You know, and we were talking about that the other day. I don't know how that ever came about. I have no idea. But my idol, as you know, growing up near the Chicago area, was Bob Rush with the Chicago Cubs. And that's the reason I wore number 17. That is the only reason. And Rush had kind of a high kick and was a big power pitcher back in the late 50s. And that's where I think I got it from.
Wow. Who did you most fear coming into the batter's box?
There was only one guy that really beat my brains out, and he beat him out all the time. It was Boog Powell, Mr. Beer Light himself. I just could not get Boog out. Boog was a guy. It got so bad at one time, I used to tell him what was coming. And then I would tell him another pitch and throw another pitch, and he'd still hit it, so it didn't make any difference. But he owned me. And yet the most significant thing that happened in 1968 with Boog Powell is the Baltimore Orioles in the first or second inning of the ball game had men on first and second and nobody out, and I never beat Baltimore. And Boog Powell hit into a triple play back to me. It was a line drive back to me. I threw to second, and they threw it on to first, and we won the ball game easily after that. But that was the most dramatic moment of the season for us. I mean, it was one of the turning points.
And next year, of course, this in 69, that was really the Orioles year. And you were saying a moment ago that you pitched better in 69. But, it occurs to me that no matter how good a team is, if there's another team that's even better, what can you do?
Well, every dog has its day.
That's right.
And I always said in the middle, late 60s, the best ball club in baseball was the Baltimore Orioles. They had terrific pitching. They were deep in the bullpen, and they had at every position, they had guys who knew how to play the game. And that means a lot more than having a lot of talent, although they were also very talented. That was as talented as a ball club as I've ever seen. They talk about the Cincinnati Reds in the middle 70s. Listen, that Baltimore club ate up everybody. And their pitching kept everybody else off the bases. When you take the Frank Robinsons and the Boog Powells and the Brook Robinsons and you put them out there, it's tough to beat guys like that because they're so experienced and they know the conditions and they know the situations in the game, and that means more than great talent.
Sure. You've had a few strikes against you to balance against those glory moments of yours.
There have been a few ups and a few downs. The downs, of course, the most dramatic being when I went to jail for 30 months. But fortunately for me, the system has checks and balances in it. The Court of Appeals in Atlanta, they reversed and threw out the conviction. Unfortunately, now on the downside, that the government's talking about doing it again in October of this year. We don't understand why. It's absurd to waste this kind of money to pursue me. And hopefully we can resolve it before then. But if we have to go to trial, we'll be ready.
Does it seem to you, though, like everyone is going to jail these days, that there's no stigma attached to it anymore?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure if there's not a stigma attached to it. I don't think you can ever overcome that. It's something that I wake up with every day, and I think about it. Maybe the general public doesn't think about it as much, and I suppose there's some truth to that. Because, you know, you read so much about so many different people and so many different walks of life. While it's not a generally acceptable thing, I don't think any of us really waste a lot of time about thinking about other people's problems. You know, we all have so many other things that we have to take care of. We have our own families, have our own children, have our own bills to pay. So that we can't waste a lot of time. We may have sympathy and compassion for others, but we certainly don't have enough time. And we all like to get involved, I think, when somebody is down. But resources probably prevent a lot of us from being able to do that.
I'm sure that everyone must ask you everywhere you go, every public appearance you make, what happened? What went wrong?
Well, a number of things. Made a lot of stupid errors in judgment. As I wrote the book, there were over 2,000 pages that I hand wrote. Toughest thing was editing it down to the 300 pages or so that we've had to put together. But I noticed a trend, and while I always thought that I was not very good at details, it became so obvious it was like being hit with a 747. I just have never, ever dotted the I's and crossed the T's. I've never really relied on the people around me to make decisions for me. And it seems like as I got into this thing, the more there was resistance, the more I wanted to do it. Bullheadedness, ego, of course, greed, of course, but it was just the details. Had I checked some of the things out in my life that I should have, the way all good businessmen do, I would not have had any problems or very few. And that's the most unfortunate thing. I now know better, but it's way after the fact.
But you're not any more gullible or any more unsuspecting than the rest of us, are you?
I don't know. My wife thinks that anybody can come to my front door and sell anything. I'm the guy. Let me tell you how bad I am. I'm the guy that when you see an 800 number on television, I'm one of those guys they're getting to. There isn't any 800 thing that I don't think I've called for.
The operators are standing by and they pick up the phone. Hi, Denny.
and they don't even say, Mr. McLean, they just said, hello, Denny, how are you today? I go for all of it. But
when a woman does that, they say, oh, she's just an impulse shopper. That's the way women are. But a man's not supposed to do that, are they?
I'm very impulsive, obviously. Maybe a man isn't supposed to do that. I know this guy's done it for a long time, and my wife, Sharon, is real tired of it, but... every Japanese knife I have and every Vegematic I have, you know, I've got all of those things. And don't ask me why. It's just an impulse. And I work on it. I'm not sure if you become an 800 junkie. I'm not sure if that's what it's all about. But, you know, I'm just terrible at details. I want to do everything that comes before me seems like an opportunity. And I never look at the downside. And obviously, it's caused me some problems.
Is there one question that you're asked everywhere you go by everyone you meet that you wish you could answer one more time and then you'd never have to hear it again?
The Mickey Mantle story. Where you know I was accused of allowing Mantle to hit a home run. Although I enjoy telling the story, that it has become a little redundant because Mickey has told it in his book. We've told it in our book, and it's a great story on a speaking tour at dinners and et cetera. But on radio, television, or even a newspaper, it's tough to tell the whole story because it takes about 20 minutes to tell, and I hate to give it not what it deserves. Because it took about 8 or 10 minutes for Mantle to actually hit the ball. And the bottom line was, despite the fact that I threw the ball in for Mick to hit, he still had to hit the ball out of the ballpark. Because, you know, the home run hitting contest they have around the major league parks, and they give guys 10 pitches to hit. Most of the time, guys don't hit one out of the ballpark. And Mantle had one strike, one chance, and he hit it out of the ballpark. So, and Mickey was my idol. You know, they talk about Ted Williams, and they talk about Mel Ott, and they talk about Ty Cobb. It's only one Mickey Mantle, and he's a national treasure. He will always will be, because he played the game the way it was supposed to be played.
Now, back in 68, Denny McLain swept the American League Cy Young Award and Most Valuable Player Award that year. He also won the Cy Young the next year, 1969, but then his career was cut short by rotator cuff issues and off-the-field issues. And Denny McLain, who is 75 now, has never been inducted into baseball's Hall of Fame. I'm Bill Thompson, and now I've heard everything.